This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Sigmund Freud constructed a model of the modern mind in his theories of psychoanalysis. He thought he'd uncovered a universal concept that would apply in any cultural setting. Those theories were used to support European imperialism, and that had accelerated by the time Freud wrote, and later they'd be used to explain anti-colonial rebellion as well. Examining the role psychoanalysis played in the concept of white supremacy and the justification of imperialism can offer insights in today's globalized economy and our ideas about the way wealth is distributed. A new collection of essays looks at how the concept of the mind shaped our understanding of colonialism and globalization. Deborah Jensen is with us. She is a professor of French Studies and Romance Studies at Duke University. She's co-director of the Haiti Humanities Laboratory and is an editor and contributor to a new book called Unconscious Dominions, Psychoanalysis, Colonial Trauma, and Global Sovereignties. And she joins us in the studio now. Deborah, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Psychoanalysis and colonialism, how are they linked?
They are linked in the sense that Freud always had a dark continent and a space of primitive otherness at the heart of his ideas. And many of his constructs in psychoanalysis were very much based on the Western bourgeois family. They're very Victorian in nature. They assume a patriarchal father in a specifically sexually inhibited, religiously inflected familial setting. But then he also theorizes civilization and its discontents yielding into spaces of cultural otherness.
And how is this brought together? We said in the introduction that it in some ways supported these theories. I mean, how did that work? He's got theories about psychoanalysis and what's troubling, you know, what's going on with the mind. And as you said, in a particular time and place, yeah, how can we use this to support ideas of imperialism?
Right. Well, one of the interesting ways to consider psychoanalysis is that it's one of the avant-gardes of neurology, of neuroscience as we know it today. Freud was a neurologist. He worked with other neurologists like Charcot. And psychoanalysis, which theorized a globalized unconscious and universal structures like the ego and the superego, was useful for colonial medical departments, for instance, in theorizing what was wrong with indigenous subjectivities, and particularly how this was involved in rebellions against the colonial civilizing mission. And so although psychoanalysis theoretically had within itself the space to explain any contradictions and to embrace contradictions and an internal otherness, nevertheless, it was used to repress colonized others.
And it's important to see this in the context in which these ideas are used, because for us it's hard to imagine that I would think anything is wrong with you if you wanted to escape, if you didn't want to be colonized, or if you didn't want to be enslaved. But for the colonizers and the slaveholders, they couldn't understand this because, after all, they were bringing civilization and Christianity and all these great things that were going to make your life better. Why would you want to leave that?
Exactly. And in the Haitian context, beginning in the 18th century, medical colonial physicians were observing the behavior of newly arrived slaves and noting that they were often subject to this sort of catatonic languor, which they called stomach pain, but which they really theorized as a form of profound nostalgia and distress. They saw it as a grief state that was making these slaves useless to the colonial project. And the irony is that this also was one of the early theorizations of subjectivity on the part of the colonized. But they did not have the goal of helping slaves, of finding any kind of a clinical insight. On the contrary, they just wanted to make the whole colonial machine function better.
You talked about that irony or that paradox, because on the one hand, the Europeans went in assuming everybody thought like they did. Everybody came from the same backgrounds, and so we would appreciate all of the same material benefits that this should bring. But on the other hand, if you say, well, you're experiencing this because of the grief of loss, you've been separated from your family, that suggests that you are looking at things another way, this subjectivity that now sort of percolates to the surface in the first studies of colonial minds.
That's right. And then these studies of slaves actually influenced the precursor thoughts for psychoanalysis, because they called that stomach pain hypnosis, or at least at a certain point in the 19th century, they began to call it that. And then hypnosis, the grief of slaves, gradually entered a culture that was becoming increasingly interested in the brain and in dreams and in everything that is irrational about human beings around the world. And this fed that psychoanalytic interest in a universal, a very complex subject.
Complex and confused at times, because at least one observer called this condition sleeping sickness, which easily got confused with the medical condition.
That's right. And in fact, they were often observing a medical condition, trypanosomiasis, and thinking that it was psychological. And that's one of the ironies of this. But yes, Freud theorized that the ego is never the master in its own house. And that space of rebellion within the human subject, as Freud theorized it, ends up being very helpful in decolonial movements, even when psychoanalysis is helping to reinforce the medical colonial system in a given country. Because in effect, the house that psychoanalysis was building was very much a Western bourgeois house, but the ego was never master in that house. And as a result, you could take that house and use it to theorize all kinds of collapses of authority, challenges to authority, and how these play out in relation to the different structures of the self.
So let's talk first of all about the reinforcement. Again, this phrase that Freud uses, the dark continent. This is suggesting a kind of inferiority, and it's a metaphor for him, but it becomes something that's in play politically as well.
Absolutely. He has some metaphors that come from Greek and Roman culture, and those structures tend to be inherently sort of sympathetic with regards to the human subject. And then the African and Middle Eastern-derived metaphors may be very negative. And so the space of metaphor is important. Now, when the British colonial medical branch of the military began to use psychoanalytic practices, or at least some analysts who were associated with the military began to practice in India, Indian psychoanalysts emerged who specifically tried to relate all of this to Hindu beliefs, to Hindu culture. And this is where you see that bifurcation in the way that psychoanalysis could be used, both in a sense to over-socialize and repress the colonized subjects, and at the same time to create bridges between Europe and parts of world histories that were not being privileged in European discourses.
This was also happening in Haiti, where I understand there was a robust study of psychoanalysis.
That's right. One of the things that I only learned about after I did this first phase of research is that the Dr. Louis Mars, who was the son of the great Haitian anthropologist Jean Price Mars, founded ethnopsychiatry in Haiti slightly earlier than it was really developed in France. And he was working with people in the U.S. and in France. And he was particularly interested in hypnotic states in Haitian voodoo rituals and how he could use these to theorize the irrational, but from a sympathetic, internally understanding and rooted cultural vantage point. So instead of theorizing the primitive other, which is the kind of construct that he always put in quotation marks, he's trying to understand how dissociation in voodoo might have, for instance, curative capacities, as dissociation was being worked with through the talking cure and psychoanalysis. And that Haitian ethnopsychiatry became part of a fairly widespread intellectual movement in Haiti that extended for several decades.
And it seems to me the tie that binds all of this and all of the cultures is separation. While Western Europeans are separating themselves from nature in their thought and in their economic activity, they're also separating colonists from their cultures, sometimes from their land, and all of them are in one way or another exhibiting signs of mental distress.
Exactly. And cultures like post-independence Brazil and Argentina became extremely invested in trying to understand what they considered to be a kind of psychic degeneration that they were partly interpreting in relation to the mixed ethnic backgrounds of their populations. And then there were large-scale migrations from Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century that helped Argentina and Brazil to set up some of the largest psychoanalytic establishments that exist anywhere in the world. So that Argentina, I believe, does still have the largest and most active psychoanalytic environment in the world.
We're talking about the study of the mind, how it contributed to colonialism and decolonialism, and how it may be part of globalization as well, or at least help us understand where we're headed. Deborah Jensen is a professor at Duke University and co-director of the Haiti Humanities Lab. Just ahead, we're going to talk about the connection between modern globalized world and colonialism. We'll do that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today about the history of colonialism. My guest, Duke Professor Deborah Jensen, co-editor and contributor to a recently released book called Unconscious Dominions, Psychoanalysis, Colonial Trauma, and Global Sovereignties. Joining us now is Walter Mignolo. He's a professor of romance studies and a professor of literature and cultural anthropology at Duke University, co-director of the Center for Global Studies and Humanities there, and author of The Darker Side of Western Modernity, Global Futures, Decolonial Options. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
We can see a link, certainly, between colonialism and globalization. Is it a clean link? Is this a real lineage, or is there a fundamental break between what we now call the globalized economy and colonialism?
Right. Every history is related to a kind of specific project. So what I'm going to say presupposes the geopolitics of knowledge, as we call it, meaning that globalization is not just seen from the north, from Western Europe or European Union or United States, but it's also seen and sensed by the people who are at the other end of globalization. So everything I write and I say is from the other perspective, from the receiving end. Even if in the United States, I was born and educated in Argentina, and Argentina, you know, was part of Tahuantinsuyo, and Tahuantinsuyo was the territory of the Incas. So that is the introduction. What we claim, and when I said we, is a kind of group, a team, a research team, a think tank that started in 98. We claim that globalization is the last stage we know of what started in the 16th century, and that we call coloniality rather than colonialism. Colonialism historical specific moments, like Spanish colonialism or Portuguese colonialism or British colonialism or U.S. colonialism. But coloniality is the underlying logic. So to answer to your question, yes, of course. The logic coloniality is still well and alive in the type of coloniality that is being called globalization.
And in order to establish yourself as a colonial power, you also have to establish that logic as the privileged logic. What is knowledge, the knowledge that's privileged? It will now replace what you... And I think you make a great example in the book about the relationship, the European relationship with between humans and nature, and how that was different from the Inca idea, and why those right. why those two would come in conflict.
Mm-hmm. And that has not gone away, because if on the one hand globalization continues the logic of coloniality, it continues the racialization of the globe. And the racialization of the globe is not the racialization of people, it's racialization of areas. So what is the big issues now that we have in Latin America is a kind of a struggle between the idea of the development and the reinscription of Pachamama and Summa Causae, all this kind of concept of indigenous philosophy. And that is a tremendous struggle on...
And how are they different? Describe the difference between those two ways of relating to the natural environment.
Well, I give you an example. The fight now in Peru and Bolivia and in Colombia and Argentina is what they call open sky mining. That requires tons of cyanide, tons of water, pollution of water, et cetera, et cetera. So how they differ, what is the difference? I think to put it in a very, very kind of short way, development, privilege economic growth at the expenses of human life. And the indigenous view privilege human life and the life of nature, which doesn't mean that that they want to be just static and not to kind of make advancement on the kind of living condition. On the contrary, the philosophy of Summa Causae is to live in plenitude while development, precisely, and this is the argument, development is just killing the killing nature, killing people, just to justify economic growth and benefit from the corporation, because this is a fight against the transnational corporation.
Right, and this is possible only when you've commodified almost every aspect of life, a process that took place slowly in European history. When we talk about the European idea about man and nature, that wasn't always the case. And so back in the 15th century, these things were still in contention even in Europe, and we saw women's relationship with reproduction and medicine changing as those industries were professionalized and commodified. So Deborah Jensen, getting back to psychoanalysis, that's what Freud was looking at, wasn't he? A European culture that was in crisis because it had changed its relationship over these few hundred years or so.
Absolutely. And let me just digress for one moment to say that the Haitians in the Haitian Revolution identified with the Incas. Once in Haiti before the earthquake, I was in the archives and I was very moved to find a manuscript document that said the Inca army, and it was a Haitian military document. But yes, at the time that Freud was conceptualizing his whole theory of the psyche and its disequilibrium, he was very aware of a civilization and its discontents on a global scale. And psychoanalysis was really very responsive to the variety of those discontents.
And enslaved people in this country as well related closely to the Haitians, particularly when they won independence. So these connections ran very deep.
And
not always rational. Walter, what was the relationship of religion, or what role did religion play in all of these changes?
I want to, before that, I want to say something about the commodification of everything. I think in the 16th century, that kind of psychology, if I can call it like that, began, because African slavery is the first moment of the modern colonial world that we call capitalism also, of the commodification of life. Commodification of life means not just that they were bought and sold. It means that as any commodity, you use it and you throw it, and you replace it with another new community. So your question was...
religion.
Religion. Yeah. Well, this is a very thorny issue and very complicated, so I try to just respond in 1, 2, 3 kind of snapshot. Well, religion in the 16th century was, on the one hand, what Christianity did. It was a companion of imperialism. But on the other hand, you have people like Bartolomé de las Casas, that were kind of critique of the excesses of the conquistadores, but also a critique of the church not doing. So that is one of the big things. The second thing, and more important, is how they use Christianity to demonize all the religion of the world. Not in the 16th century yet, but in the 18th century. In the 16th century, what they decided is that the Indian did not have religion, because they were coming from the three religions of the book. So they were just Muslim and Jews and Christian. And the moment of the conquest, as you know, is the moment in which the Jews and Muslim are expelled.
From Spain.
Yeah. So, and the principle of purity of blood is being applied to kind of control. And in South America, so they decide that the Indians are kind of controlled by the devil, and that they have to extirpate idolatry. They say extirpation of idolatry was really an epistemic lobotomy, because they were trying to kind of extract it. Now, the question is that in the 18th century, when secularism comes, and we know that all the enlightened philosophers kind of fight against and demonize Christianity and religion, but really they have to keep religion in place, because Christianity becomes the buffer zone against Muslim and Jews, and also to demonize now Oriental religions, Buddhism and all this kind of thing. So on the one hand, religion, in a nutshell, religions, institutional religion, plays a tremendous role in kind of in the formation of imperial coloniality or colonial matrix of power. But on the other hand, there's a tremendous force of decolonization. And now what is going on in the Andes, but also in Native American theologian, is that they are kind of decolonizing religion to liberate spirituality. And as you know, spirituality for Indians from the Andes to the Native Americans is related to land. So land, there you have another answer to the first question. Land is not a private property that should be used to develop, but land is life. And land is a spirituality. Land is what... So it's a very complex...
So it's used now to bring back together those things that were separated, land, life, mm-hmm. spirit, mm-hmm. that spiritual lobotomy that Walter mm-hmm. talks about, in a sense, the separation of the spirit or the irrational that Christians didn't recognize as part of the human understanding.
And Freud was very interested in how we establish religious authority psychically, how we establish totems and taboos, mm-hmm. and how monotheism reflects, for instance, the role of the superego, which he saw as that kind of disciplinary presence of our conscience. And so he's very interested in charting these things in terms of a universal psychology. And you can see how much it did open pathways for comparative anthropological understandings of human beings, mm-hmm. Even if at the same time it was very much modeled on a particular culture and the assumptions of that culture, such that the Marxists, for instance, rejected psychoanalysis because they viewed it as overly Eurocentric, bourgeois, etc. But it was meant to open doors to understanding how many cultures might, for instance, relate mm-hmm. to the spiritual.
And it appears to be having that effect. It certainly has had mm-hmm. that effect mm-hmm. over time. So now, as we look at this new era of globalization, and we see the center shifting from Europe and the U.S., obviously, to the East and China, do we expect a different way of thinking, different kinds of religious, spiritual, or sort of intellectual models that we'll then have to all embrace in order to play the game?
Well, I just this morning in Argentina, I was publishing an op-ed of mine on toward de-Occidentalization. And the thesis there is that for 500 years, what we call coloniality, or it's a shorthand of colonial matrix of power, and colonial matrix of power is a structure of control, domination, management. So that coloniality, that 500 years of coloniality that was created, transformed, and controlled by the West, from Spain to France to England to the United States, that is what is changing, because the dispute that we are looking at today is the dispute for the control of the colonial matrix of power. So de-Occidentalization, that is a kind of a political project that is being articulated from East Asia, that China is not just an economic power, it's kind of articulating itself through Confucianism, etc. But de-Occidentalization is not a geographic concept, it's a political concept, because now, believe it or not, you may be surprised, And that is what happened in the last meeting of the consortium of Latin American countries. Latin America is going toward the occidentalization. It's no longer the left. It's no longer decolonization. And what does it mean? It means, in a nutshell, that capitalism, that kind of economy of accumulation, exploitation, in Brazil or in China or in the United States or European Union, is not questioned. So the crisis, people are trying to say capital. But this, what is going on in the non-Western world, non-Western Europe, is that they don't want to receive order from the IMF, from the World Bank, or from the European Central Bank. So that is on the one hand, and the other phenomenon I will call decolonization. That is not at the level of the state, but it's the level of a political society. So Tunisia, Egypt, Greece, yeah, before that Bolivia and Ecuador, Occupy United States, things are changing massively.
It suggests that you can break with the Western institutions that have enforced Western-based, Western-centered capitalism, but doesn't suggest necessarily that the rules of capitalism change or that they're not directing the show. Is it cultural exactly. thought that guides the system, or is the system now controlling
That is what I think is what we have to think in the next 10, 20 years. Yes, because, I mean, China is polluting the air as much as the kind of the Western corporation. There is kind of violence of human rights as well as in the West. So all the kind of the bad things of the capitalist economy are being maintained. And the question is who rules, who called the shot?
And whether or not there's the psychological component plays a role, does it follow? Does our sort of analysis of psychology follow the structure, or do we sort of get control of it?
That's right. What is the transference going on between cultures? Psychoanalysis really relies on a model of transferential energies between the two participants in the talking cure. Mm-hmm. And you can see this kind of transference in the globalization of cultural exchange and of capitalism.
How so?
In the sense that you have a dynamic space in which in that encounter you will change, and yet you may have poles of dominance that will continue to govern what the results of, mm-hmm. of that dynamic exchange mm-hmm. will be. And so that, for instance, is capitalism as an economic system going to, as Walter, I think, is suggesting, replace Western authority as an authority that is a bit of a wild card culturally?
And I've seen those who've suggested that colonialization it goes on within countries. Certainly in China, it's colonization of Western Turkic peoples, the Uyghurs extracting resources, treating them as second-class citizens. Their activity in Sudan, the colonial interest there in extracting oil in China. And even some would say in the United States, there was a time when there was a more egalitarian distribution of both wealth and power. When workers actually had some leverage against the corporation through unions to negotiate their own conditions. Today, people will do anything for a job in the same sense that colonial peoples, having had their economies replaced, were at the mercy of the colonial power. And so once we've commodified your economy, you've got to come to us for a job. It's happening in this country, too.
And people are now looking at the unconscious in neuroeconomic models of mm-hmm. capitalism, for instance, which is a whole new phase in the development of these psychological models.
Now, what do you mean?
Neuroeconomics looks at ways that on a neurological level that may have no access to our conscious minds, that our decision-making processes are playing into the systems in which we are embedded economically. Mm-hmm. And so free will there, as in psychoanalysis, is not at the forefront. There is a role of a kind of unconscious process, but it is perceived as being neurological as opposed to a product of consciousness.
It raises questions about computer-driven trading as well, all of which are based on algorithms that suggest human behavior, but ultimately become their own rule, their own set of rules. They're running the show in a way. Mm-hmm.
Now, what I think is, I think it's very important to look at all those things, to look at how the colonial mixture of power is kind of being maintained, transformed and maintained, and those are kind of... But I think we have to look at what are the consequences. and not to pay too much attention to what the people who are trying to maintain capitalism or this system are doing and how the mind works, but what are the consequences of that? Because I think that the future is no longer being decided by the state and the corporation, but by what I call the political society. And we are seeing all over the place that the political society is becoming more and more aware of the situation. And I think that the transformation of the future is not coming from the West or from capitalism. The transformation will be coming from the organization of the political society.
Do you think so? You think that awareness, say the Occupy Wall Street movement, is that what you're thinking of? And movements like that around the world will actually translate to political power and change?
Right. I mean, the Occupy is the closest and the latest. But if you look at Ecuador, Bolivia, at the beginning of the 2000, Evo Morales is there because of this. So what happened then in Tunisia, what happened then in Egypt, what happened, et cetera, et cetera. So as you were saying a moment ago, look what happened in Europe. In Europe, what happened in Latin America in the 60s, the project of development and modernization kind of collapse. And now Europe is collapsing. And who is collapsing? The periphery of Europe.
I tell you what, we're going to take a break right here, talking to Walter Mignolo, professor of Romance Studies at Duke, Deborah Jensen, professor of French Studies at Duke. And just ahead, we're going to look at bioethics and the new face of Western colonization. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, looking at the line that connects colonialism and globalization this hour. My guest, Deborah Jensen, professor of French Studies and Romance Studies at Duke, editor and contributor to the book Unconscious Dominion, Psychoanalysis, Colonial Trauma, and Global Sovereignties. Walter Mignolo is with us, a professor of Romance Studies and Cultural Anthropology at Duke, runs the Center for Global Studies and Humanities, and he is the author of The Darker Side of Western Modernity, Global Futures, Decolonial Options. Joining us now is Stuart Rennie. He is an assistant professor in social medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the co-principal investigator of Fogarty Bioethics Projects in Congo and South Africa. Stuart, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Bioethics is something that we would all assume is a good thing and has ethics at the end of it. So ethics is good. And yet the frame of this conversation is, the conceit is that somehow it is an extension of colonialization. Is that true and how?
I'll see if I can connect the dots. And I think the one way of connecting the dots there is to think about how biomedical research has been globalized throughout the world. More and more there's research by so-called developed countries taking place in developing countries, mostly because of economic reasons and mostly because the persons there are easier to recruit and perhaps the regulations are more lax. This situation, which is the rich, in a sense, studying the poor, leads to a possibility of exploitation, that relationship would be an exploitive relationship. That's already an ethical issue right there with the whole framework of global health research possibly being an instance of neocolonial exploitation, especially when you see that a lot of the research which is being done may not actually benefit the people who are being studied. A lot of the biomedical discoveries or the data that comes out of it doesn't find itself channeled back into the health systems of those countries, so those countries may not benefit. Most of global health research is not research about conditions and diseases which afflict the poor.
Although you do have a good example of an AIDS study, for instance, that could potentially help the people of that continent.
True. You do have.
And give us that example. Tell us about that particular example where there was an AIDS drug that was promising and given as there was a placebo group as well.
That's a case which is one of the more controversial cases, and that is the AIDS research done during the 1990s and around the turn of the century on mother-to-child transmission, where in the United States they had found that giving ACT, so a drug to HIV-positive pregnant mothers, would reduce the possibility that their children would be HIV positive. They gave a very long course of this treatment in the United States, leading up until labor and then afterwards for the child. So it was very intensive, also very expensive. And then after that, they thought, well, how are we going to try to test this in the countries which are the most affected by this? And those were low-income or resource-poor countries. So they decided they were going to do a short course of the same treatment. They were going to run a study which showed the short course in one arm of the study and placebo in the other. Now, this couldn't be this research couldn't be conducted, say, in the United States, because when you have the long course and it's proven effective, that is the standard of care. And that is what you would compare. A short course would be compared against a long course, but it was done with placebo. Now, the question there was, is this a case of exploitation? Knowing that in the placebo arm, that children are going to be HIV infected, guaranteed because of the background HIV prevalence in those countries. So is that study design a question of exploitation, or, as some other people have argued, it's a quicker, less expensive way of running a study? A placebo-controlled study is less expensive, and it's more, a short course is more appropriate for those countries because it's also cheaper, and because women don't appear at health clinics until right about the time when they give birth, regardless.
But in that case, the complaint is that you tried something in a place where you tried something that you couldn't get away with in the United States. It would not have been legal here or ethical here. It was there, so we did it. And what that suggests is that there is just not a standard that applies to everybody.
Or there's a double standard. That was the complaint about those studies, is that what you have then is an ethical double standard, where certain kinds of trial designs are good enough for the developing world.
The other part of this question of colonialization and whether bioethics is an extension of that is, when you try to get a single standard, when you try to wipe out the double standard, how do you do it? Do you simply impose Western ethics and Western standards and say, hi, folks, we're here to do a study and here's how it's done?
Right. That has been a bit the quest in the West among bioethicists, has been to try to see if one can formulate an actual universal standard which isn't some kind of modified form of Western thought. Because if it is only a modified form of Western thought, you call it universal and then start applying it around the world, you're in fact just imposing Western values using another name. It's just so-called universal.
So, Deborah Jensen, this is exactly what we're seeing, you know, and again, with the application of psychoanalysis and whose thought dominates who and what ideas we privilege.
That's right. And one of the fascinating genealogies is between psychoanalysis, colonialism, and global health, which is very eager to not repeat any of the errors of the civilizing mission. And so how does global health go around avoiding these things? It tries to use community-based methodologies. It tries to establish new measures, for instance, idioms of distress measures in place of PTSD measures. So there are a lot of ways in which, in the context of global health research, people are very specifically encountering these translational problems of cultural environments and Western medical apparatus and are trying to renegotiate it.
Well, I'd like you to go into some detail on that, the distinction between PTSD and idioms of distress. Is it just semantics? Is it just
language? The idea is that PTSD, in a sense, I mean, trauma was a psychoanalytic notion, and it then, of course, became part of the diagnostic criteria in the DSM. And the one could almost say that diagnostic criteria have killed psychoanalysis in the U.S. But so PTSD is viewed by many as being quite culture bound, and yet everybody knows that there's a universal response to trauma and that this has legacies that may border on disorder. And so rather than simply applying questionnaires that have been derived in conjunction with the DSM criteria, if you allow people to describe their own experience of trauma and how they see it as having impacts, you may find better clinical methods. On the other hand, if you don't use the measures from a society like the U.S., you will never have a closed feedback loop with the research community. And so at the Haiti Lab, for instance, we're trying to do both. We actually are doing a PTSD prevalence study, but we're also studying all of the other discourses of trauma.
So how do you balance those things, Stuart Rennie, the subjectivity of the people who are being studied and perhaps helped with the kind of objective standard by which all things should be measured?
That is, if you look at it, I think theoretically, and it would be very hard for people like from the West, where bioethics, in a sense, was born, is the United States through its particular history about scarce rationing of dialysis and end-of-life issues and abortion and all the long list of possible bioethics issues. It would be very hard to try to escape this when one is engaging with others and talking about bioethics. In practice, there is sometimes some room for maneuver when you're actually engaging with other people. And it's what do you do when traditions of thought encounter one another? Usually it's not irreconcilable differences all the way down the line. There's usually some overlaps. There's usually some places for dialogue and also for mutual adjustment. We see that in our project where we have we see researchers, Western researchers, saying, well, we don't know whether we should ask children for their agreement in research or not in the Congo, for instance, because they don't usually ask children for their agreement about much of anything in the Congo, medical or otherwise. And then we ask, well, is this really culturally inappropriate, completely culturally inappropriate what we're asking, because we treat children differently, say, in the United States? And it turns out that there is actually, amongst parents and doctors, they tend to see children as having absolutely no voice, whereas children themselves see themselves as they should be asked these sort of questions. So it's a bit of a mixed picture.
You wouldn't have even known that if you hadn't asked the kid how he felt. So
yeah, definitely.
Don't ask. But how about some deeper, call them religious or spiritual questions? The connection between humans and the land, the commodification of land and resources in the way Westerners might see it. Does that run? Is there any conflict in developing bioethics when these deep fundamental spiritual ideas differ?
It definitely differs when you're talking about the globalization, if you're talking about the globalization of what is called Western bioethics, because through the history in the United States, bioethics has been very secularized. Mainstream bioethics in the United States is secularized, and it was secularized for a reason, I believe, in the history, is that people wanted to rise above all the intractable conflicts of religious views in the United States. And so you tried to create this sort of secular discourse. When you take this secular discourse on the road, you run into, certainly in Central and Southern Africa, I've never met an atheist on my tour. And so you're immediately confronted with very spiritual ideas about end-of-life issues or about participation in research or the social value of research and secular ones. And those are sometimes very, very hard to negotiate. At some points, pretty much impossible to negotiate.
Walter Mignolo, I wonder how this plays out. We talked about these new movements now, broader democratic movements that we're seeing all over the world. But these are very serious questions that would have to be negotiated within groups and then among groups as any kinds of coalition or change would come about.
Yes, I think in relation to what has been said, I would say that psychoanalysis is universal from the regional perspective of the West. You were talking about different system of thought, and that is not necessarily universal for the kind of Igbo in Africa or the Aymara, etc. So that, in relation to your question, is that the struggle of the 21st century, Du Bois said that the color line was the struggle of the 20th century. the struggle of the 21st century is the epistemic line. That means knowledge. Because if you don't control knowledge, knowledge will control you. And in that sense, psychoanalysis ran the risk. And Fanon said it. As a psychoanalyst, when he went to Algeria and faced the Berber, well, that didn't work. Ashish Nandi wrote the book called Savage Freud, because in India, that is another thing. So what I think is interesting also in what you were saying, and we see that in the Andes. But in the Andes, how the two systems of the kind of the Western medicine and indigenous medicine gets together. So what we are seeing in the manifestation on the street is not just a manifestation of the street. I think that there is behind that is a struggle for knowledge. And in this sense, controlling knowledge is who controls the economic and political vision that the state will implement. In Bolivia and Ecuador, when they talk about the plurinational state, what do they mean? It means that the modern state in Europe was mono culture. While when you go to the colonies, you find, except China, but you find you find many, many nations. So the struggle for a plurinational state is a struggle for political theory and political economy, for knowledge. It's not that the indigenous people just take the street. They are taking over knowledge, and they create an institution like Amau Taiwasi, which is a kind of indigenous university for everybody.
Well, so that's happening in the street. Let me ask each of you very briefly what you think is the role of the Western Academy in contributing to this conversation and this negotiation. Mm-hmm. Deborah?
As we learn more about how to work with other cultures, how to work in universities that move across borders, for instance, one of the questions that we encounter is that of overdetermining alterity and underestimating universal bonds. And so this is something that I think is now coming to the fore in sophisticated anthropological terms, and it's important.
Stuart?
I think from my experiences that I've had in talking about ethics when in Central Africa is from the view of someone from the West, like I am from the Western tradition, is that it's easy to fall into the trap of being like a colonist when there's this very large distinction, there's very great inequalities, and they're factual. They may be unjust, and I think they are unjust, but they're factual and they're there, and they have effects. So it's very hard to escape. It's like a trap, and you should never think that you've actually escaped from this trap. I think that it is part of you more than you know, and almost always when you're thinking that you're really helping, you may not be. Mm.
Walter Mignolo, I've only left you about 30 seconds.
Well, I think that it has been said. There are two roles. I mean, on the one hand, the American Academy is contributing to kind of prolong imperialism, forming experts and all these kind of things. But as you see this morning, also there is academic and a scholar there trying to kind of stop that kind of and work with people in the different parts of the world differently.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Walter Mignolo, professor of romance studies and a professor of literature and cultural anthropology at Duke. Author of The Darker Side of Western Modernity, Global Futures, Decolonial Options. Stuart Rennie is an assistant professor in social medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, co-principal investigator of the Fogarty Bioethics Projects in Congo and South Africa. Deborah Jensen is a professor of French studies, romance studies at Duke, co-director of the Haiti Humanities Laboratory, and editor and contributor to a recently released book called Unconscious Dominions. And that's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.